We're calling this Masterpiece Theater, a fireside chat. And so we'll be asking questions, and this is Dr. Scott Merritt, my son, the middle son. Are you middle? Yeah, son of middle. And he's going to be doing basically an interview, and we'll be asking a lot of questions. And this is so much open forum, so as we go along and ask questions, if there's something that we're going to lead to a little bit later, I'll put it off and lead to it again. So with that said and done, Scott?
So we're going to go through... I think probably this is... So we're going to, since we're talking about appointed prayers, we're going to go through appointed questions here. And so the first question is, what is the Amidah?
Right. Yeah, the Amidah, I think most, does everyone know what the Amidah is? Familiar with the Amidah? No? Some are more familiar with not, but the Amidah is the oldest formalized Jewish prayer, dating back even longer than the Shema. It's often called the standing prayer because, well, it's called Amidah because it is the standing prayer, and it is thus the stand. Amidah means standing, and it is a formalized prayer that is said by observant Torah observant Jews and Messianics around the world two or three times a day.
And how old is it?
How old is it?
Yes.
Ah, anybody know how old the Amidah is?
Yeah.
So some actually have claimed, particular Orthodox rabbis claim that it dates to Mount Sinai and that Moses gave this, or was given by God to Moses and to Aaron on Mount Sinai as part of the oral law. And it goes back to there. However, most scholars, even Orthodox scholars, really doubt that. It is certainly as old as 100 of the Common Era, or A.D., because we have it being formalized that in historical records at 100 A.D., and it... It's most likely dating back to right after Ezra and the formation of the great, what's called the Great Synagogue, or the Great HaKnesset was the more proper term, established after the days of Ezra when they were beginning to train people in the law after they'd come back from captivity. So sometime between that time, so we would say it's certainly 1900 years old, but could be somewhere around 2300.
So what are the other names of the Amidah? Let's go by any other names.
Anybody want to take that on, another name for the Amidah?
Shemoneh Ezreh.
Shemoneh Ezreh, which means?
18.
Means the 18, okay. Any other names? Yeah, beside Amidah, which means the standing prayer in the English translation.
Hatefillah.
Okay, and Hatefillah means? Means the prayer, yeah. The prayer is probably correct in it, or is it the prayer? The or the. Anyway, you're a scholar. The or the. Anyway, the THE prayer, Hatefillah, is often called the prayer, par excellence, because it contains the totality of blessing God, petitions from God, and thanking God, and then dates back so long, been prayed so many times for so many people for so many times, it's often referred to as, in English, the prayer, or Ha Tefillah.
So I think we got a hint, in case people were listening, but the next question is, how many parts are there?
How many parts are there in the Amidah? You want to take a guess at that or stab at it? 18, that's a good number there, 18. But if you count it, if you read it in the prayer books of today, there are 19 comparts. So there are either 18 or 19 parts to it.
We probably should hold this part right here.
Okay.
Why are the parts of the Amidah important to Jewish-Christian relations?
Why are parts of the Amidah important to Jewish-Christian relations? Who wants to take a stab at that? On the positive side, yes, because it is the model prayer. It's the prayer in which we actually bless God, and then of course we petition, and then of course we thank Him at the end. Many scholars have even shown parallels between the prayer of our Father, the so-called Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 to the Amidah. It has the same components to it. So in a positive thing, it has many components to it. On the other side, on the darker side, it was in about during the events of the first century, when there were crucifixion of the Messiah in 30 A.D. and then the 40 years after that, the growth of the Messianic religion, which was called the Nazarene religion. In that time, the new believers and the fellow Jews worshiped together, worshiped in the synagogues together. Of course, as time went on, there was more and more tensions, more strife, as you'd have in any congregation where you have people who believe a certain strong doctrine one way or another people, and the tension grew. Finally, after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem at 70 A.D., Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, and you all know the stories of his interesting escape from Jerusalem, and then meeting with Vespasian, and then being able to set up an academy at Yavna, which is near modern Tel Aviv, down the southern parts, near a stream there. An academy of Yavna was set up with Roman blessing to maintain the Jewish religion, now under the rabbis who were the Pharisee sect. So that was the beginning of rabbinical Judaism. The Nazarene believers, we would say Messianic believers, or we might call them proto-Christians, continue to worship with them with more and more attention. Now comes along a rabbi, Gamaliel II. This is not to be confused with Gamaliel I, who was actually trained the Apostle Paul. But Gamaliel II became the Nasi of the Yavna, he really wanted to get these guys out of the system, out of his hair. It's estimated that somewhere between 20% and 30% of Jews remaining in the land at that time were now believers, and of course that was a threat to his authority. There was a threat to his continuing his vision for Judaism, and so he asked. Simon the flax merchant, if he would actually formalize these into 18 codified things, so that they were in the same order. They weren't written down in those days. Everyone memorized the things. In fact, there was an edict against writing prayers, and so he codified them so to be 18. At the same time, or shortly thereafter, he asked another one of his disciples, Samuel the Younger, sometimes called Samuel the Lesser, if he would now include in those 18 a cursing against the Nostrim and the Minim. The Minim, of course, means heretics. So to be a cursing against heretics that everyone would recite when he recited the Amidah twice a day. Then at that time became three times a day. And then he also added the Nostrim in there. And the Nostrim is the Nazarenes. This prayer in its original form was actually uncovered in the Ezra Synagogue in Cairo, known as the Genistah fragments, that in here somewhere. Anyway, I'll show you that later. And so he composed this prayer of the 12th which actually cursed it. So if you were a Nazarene believer in Messiah, and Yeshua is the Messiah, you were a Nazarene, you would be cursing yourself, and you'd say that, that you have no hope. Now, and so this basically run the guys out, you know, and Yeshua said they will cast you out of the synagogues. Well, they didn't have the authority, they didn't have the authority to cast you out, that if you wouldn't go there and pray a prayer, they cursed yourself. And then they set up actually the equivalent of our deacons now that would sort of listen to people. And if you made errors in the Amidah, that was okay, you know, because people were learning and it was in memory there. If you made an error in that one, though, they would tap you on the shoulder. And pretty soon, you know, you were a persona non grata. And you were not welcome there, and pretty soon you would not be, you couldn't trade with the other guys, you couldn't sell, you couldn't buy from them, you couldn't do anything, so commerce was separated between those two. So it was actually the straw that broke the camel's back in one sense, although the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which occurred just a few years after that, the Nazarene or Nazarenes would not fight with Bar Kokhba. Why? Why would they not fight with Bar Kokhba? Yeah, Bar Kokhba was acclaimed to be the Messiah by Akiva, who was the successor to Gamaliel. And Akiva actually proclaimed him to be the Messiah. And of course, if you believe in Yeshua's Messiah, you know, is there two Messiahs? Well, it's hard to swallow, so the Nazarene did not follow him, and therefore that really further separated the community there. But anyways, one of those things that actually was a mechanism by which Yeshua had predicted that in fact they would be run out of the synagogues. And so that was the 12th prayer, 12th component. Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering why they did it, made it 12 instead of...
It actually is a flow. There is a flow, and there's a sections of these things which have to talk about personal, and then sections that have to do with corporate togetherness, and of course then it builds up into the petitions, the middle portions petitions. The 12 portions in the center are 13, it turns out to be, are petitions that go into corporate. And there is actually a pattern to it. But was that the added one? Was that why there's 12, and is that why there are 18 in some and 19 in the other? We'll talk about that in a moment. Unless Scott wants to answer that.
So Oscar's asking the time period.
The time period was around 100 CE, or this common era. Gamaliel was the Nazi in that era between about 90 CE and about 110 CE, 110, 120. And then, of course, then after that was Akiva, which came in there in the late 20s and early 30s. But it was added, and the date, if you want to put a date on it, would be 100, but 100 A.D., yeah. Gamaliel, yeah. Gamaliel was the Nazi at the time. It was actually composed by one named Samuel the Lesser, who was one of the students of Gamaliel at Gamaliel's instruction. You know, he asked him to go back home and, you know, back to his room and then to compose this and bring it to the academy, who listened to it and approved it.
I wonder if Samuel appreciated that name.
The Lesser?
Yeah. Okay. Should the believers pray the 12th blessing?
Should believers pray that 12th blessing?
Well, I don't think they don't have it in front of me, but we don't have it from me.
The way it's worded nowadays, it doesn't mention the offshore or anything. It's should actually be quite generic and acceptable for us.
That's right. Over the Middle Ages, I mean, after that split the things out, but over time, as the Roman Catholic Church, you know, took control of things, the Middle Ages rolled on, and Christianity became the dominant religion and was actually rolling over things, and now rabbinic Jews were now a minority, often persecuted and, you know, treated in all kinds of bad ways that everyone knows about. They began to modify those things. And one of the things I think is important for us to understand as we read or learn about these standing traditions, these very traditions that are very, very solid, written now into prayer books, you know, and our language, is these are things that changed over time and still changed. And so they changed the wording and modified them during the Middle Ages to be less offensive to the Christian community that they were dependent upon for trade and for life and, you know, which had life and death over them. So they did modify them. Depending on now whether you're Orthodox or whether you're conservative or you're Reformed, you may have different versions. I mean, there's even a feminist version. And in fact, if you read the Reformed versions, it's very watered down. However, a friend of mine who is a Torah observant Jew from Israel, when he visits us over here and he hears and around the country and even Israel, and he hears Messianics reading that 12th prayer, which still has the Menim in there, Menim, which are heretics, which really does point to them. So we can say ourselves. But anyway, he a bit ridicules us and say, you guys don't know what you're praying. You're praying that you're praying that. The other thing that I would throw out, and why I don't include it in mine, is that Yeshua tells us to bless our enemies and not to curse them. Now, on the other hand, you have David, you know, the prayers of David, you know, he was really like, smash those guys and grind them down and throw them in the hail. So there's a good discussion on that. I'm not going to dwell on that discussion other than to say there's two sides to that issue. I don't personally, for the things that I outlined, but then of course you brought up good points there too. Yes, ma'am. Shimha. Simha. They didn't, but many of the priests did. Many of the priests did actually study Hebrew. And in fact, many of the priests studied Hebrews under the rabbis. Many of them did. I don't know what the percentage were, but there was some understanding of basic Hebrew from the rabbinical community to the priest. And I will say this is always bad because a lot of these people got along and they were buddies, so. Yeah, they were forbidden in Yavna in the early days. In about 200 AD, I got a blank on his name. Anyway, the rabbi at that time determined that indeed things were getting so bad that they really should, because Hadrian had come through and he'd really run people out. He closed Yavna down. There was no Yavna after Hadrian, after the Bar Kokhba War. They were really scattered out. They couldn't be in the land anymore. And so he made a ruling at that time that they would write down the prayers. So around 200 AD, they wrote down the prayer and they began to write down their discussions of Yavna up until that time, which we now know as the Mishnah. And so the Mishnah, which were these oral discussions that went on from generation to generation, were written down too. I don't know the answer to that. Anybody, you know it?
We went to the academy, and the idea of disciple, I need to learn and memorize the teacher's word. I need to write back from there, and you can see him over and over and over again. You live with him, you see him with you, and you memorize it with you. If you're not with him all the time, you're not going to memorize his words, and by not being with him all the time, you can't do what he's like.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, there weren't as many, I remember those days, around 100 A.D. is when books began to be printed, codices, which were like books like we have now. Before that time, it was all scrolls, carved on the granite, stone outside your house. But, even then, in the first books, the first codices, there was not paper. Papyrus was very expensive, and of course, most of the early codices were on lambskin. And it would take, for a book this size, it may take maybe 30 or 40 lambs in order to process all that.
So,
yeah. Probably so. So writing was much more, you know, even if we, you know, the group of us were in a hot Knesset, a synagogue ourselves in the days, we might have only been able to afford one or two prayer books if they were in a prayer book. So you can only share that away so many times. Yes, sir.
I think if you were getting, you know, obviously you want to maintain a simple relationship, but being active, you know, part of course,
okay. Your name is
Aaron.
Aaron. Okay. Aaron made a nice comment here, just for recording here, that after the time of Bar Kokhba and as times got worse, that you're going to be losing a lot of those leaders. That they're going to become less and less available, and therefore you need to have, in order to disseminate things, written material. Is that a correct?
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. All right, next question here.
How often did the priests or the Levites serve in the temple?
Yeah, the where this is going is as you all obviously know, the priesthood, both the priests and the Levites were divided into 24 courses, and these courses are found when the temple itself was established, and under David and then Solomon. In First Chronicles, it's easy to remember because it's First Chronicles 23 and 24, and 23 tells about the 24 courses of the priests, 24 tells about the 24 courses of the Levites, or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway, two chapters tell about the 24 courses, and a course meant that is meant that for Levites and priests, which were scattered throughout the country, and they weren't all down in Jerusalem. They had Levitical cities, and there'd be Levites in your community and around you, and they would go up to Jerusalem to serve for 2 weeks a year. So, you'd have a regular week in the springtime, regular week sometime in the fall or winter. then everyone went up during the three pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. So in the temple, the Levites would, and the priests would go up at their appointed time. We know the story of Zechariah in Luke 2, who was of the course of Abijah, which was the eighth course. And so we actually can determine when he actually did that, because those are distinct times that they would serve. And so from the course of Abijah, you can actually calculate when that event was, and calculating some pregnancy things, you can actually come up with the season of the birth of Messiah, which, and the birth of John. So that's sort of an interesting historical side note.
What season is that?
What season is that? We'll keep on topic here. And so anyway, I'm getting off topic. Thank you, Scott. So there were 24 courses that were for the priests and Levites. Is that the question?
Yeah.
That was the question. What were the 24 courses? I just thought the season might be appropriate to this.
The answer to that is we can, at another session we can go. It actually comes out that the Messiah was born in the autumn, sometime around Sukkot.
And sometime when there was no room in the inn, I guess.
When there'd be no room in the inn around Sukkot time, yeah. Interesting, yeah.
And the
sheep were still out in the pasture, right?
So how did the Amidah start? And I think the follow-up will be, who were the men of standing?
So what does this have to do with Amidah? So what happens in the course of time is that with the 24 courses, in Torah, when a sacrifice is presented for the community, which many of the sacrifices were, there needs to be community representatives there. And you might say the Levites did it, and the priests did it, represented there, but they needed to be people of the community. And so in those days between Ezra and the first century B.C., BCE, during that time, they established 24 districts in the land, which corresponded to the districts of the Levites. So whichever, of course, if you lived in eastern Galilee, that may be course number 8, for instance, and Zechariah and the priest and the Levites associated with him would be up in there. They determined that along with the priest and the Levites and that they would actually send men, the laymen, non-priests, non-Levites, up to Jerusalem to watch the proceedings and to learn the proceedings and sort of represent the people. And so a few would go, I don't know how many, but a few would go. And they were called Anshe Ma'amadot, men of standing. Because in two sense, you know, Hebrew is always this interesting thing, two sense, because they were sort of standing in for the community there. But also because they just sort of stood around, huh? They sort of stood around and watched those sacrifices over there. So I like this because there's a movie that I don't recommend anybody see, but if you did see this movie, it's called Michael. You know, if you see that movie Michael, and it's a farce, it's Michael the Archangel comes down to save this lady who's being oppressed by the banker and all, but he's a womanizer and a drunkard and so forth. Anyway, it's a funny movie. But anyway, he's Michael and he's there driving along in this car and his reporter's onto this and his reporter's, he's seeing people in this long line over there and he says, well, in that long line over there, I invented lines. He said, you did invent lines? He says, yeah, way back when people used to just stand around all the time. It's just stand around, mull around. So I like that one. So I invented lines. So I think about it every time I'm in Shopko or Walmart and there's long lines. Anyway, the people would be there and they would just stand around. They weren't just really just mulling around and standing around. What they would do is they had their positions on the steps of the courtyard where the sacrifices would be done. And so they would actually watch the procedures and they would learn the procedures. And so twice a year, these men of standing, the Ma'amadot, would actually go up to the temple, stand as the prayers were being done, and watch them. Thus, the Levites were standing too, standing before the Lord. So everybody's standing around now. And so that was the Ma'amadot.
Did this lead to local assemblies?
What do you all think? How? Actually, it did, and this is the origin of the synagogues, because the Ma'amadot would come back, and in fact, the next time, not all of them would be able to go. Some would be able to go, and there may be other men that would go in their stead, or maybe some guy, his wife was sick, and he couldn't go that time. So what they did establish there in the Beit HaKnesset, the assembly areas, which primarily had been designed for study. Designed by Ezra and the men of the great synagogue and for study. So in these areas of study, the people began to meet at the two weeks in which their representatives were up there. And so the local people, under the leadership of these men of standing, there locally would meet. And at the time those prayers were going on, which was which was the ninth hour and the third hour, the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. They would also meet, and that they would then listen to the men standing, tell them about the prayers. And then they begin to actually read parts of the book of Genesis. And they would, so they had a book, some readings from Genesis. And then they would sing some of the Levitical choir songs that the guys had brought back. And then they would actually then go through the prayer, which included the Amidah, which was the standing prayer. So they did this, twice in the year, and then they began to do that on the three pilgrimage villages and the people who couldn't go up. And understand, even then, it was like today, how many of us do three pilgrimage festivals per year? Yeah, actually leave and go somewhere to Missouri, so yeah. But most of us, you know, struggle to do one. Well, you think it was much different then? No, probably not. So most people went up to the feast, which was Sukkot, which is really the big one, or maybe Passover. So there was a hierarchy. And so when you weren't there, what do you do when you don't go to your pilgrimage feast for Shavuot? You do something locally. And so that they begin to do that. And so under the leadership of the Ma'amadot, the men of standing who had learned these things, that had been there, had seen them, and learned those prayers, they began to do it on the festival days too. And then he gradually went on, so if you're doing that twice a year, and you're five times a year, so why not do it every Sabbath? So they begin to do the same things, and so over 100 years or more, the weekly synagogue Sabbath began, the Beit HaKnesset, the house of the assembly. And by the time of Yeshua's time and the apostles' time, guess what? They were all over the land. They were all over the world. You know, Apostle Paul could get one and he'd travel across them to Greece and over to Spain, and guess what? There were synagogues meeting on the Sabbath day and having the morning and the evening prayers there. And so it became very, very popular. Even in Jerusalem, it's estimated there was probably about 100 synagogues within the city of Jerusalem. You think they would just all go up to the temple. But I don't know what the excuse for that is, but that's just one thing. Yes, ma'am. Olga? That's great. She asked, we're talking about the time period between Malachi and the New Testament, this thing developed, and the answer is, yeah, that's the period we're talking about. And on up into the New Testament time, it's still developing. Sima.
When these guys were up at the temple for 2 weeks, somebody else maybe who had been there before was teaching back at home.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
So I think you touched on it. Should the Amidah be prayed how many times per day?
How many times a day should the Amidah be prayed? Well, we're referring to in the biblical terms in Numbers 28. It talks about the prayers before the sacrifices. It mentions the morning and the evening. The morning and the evening sacrifice. The morning sacrifice being done sometime between sunrise and 9 o'clock, the third hour, and the evening sacrifice sometimes between 3 p.m. and sunset. One is called Shacharit, which comes from Shahar, which means morning or dawn, and the other refers to Minha, which actually refers to the name of the grain sacrifice, the grain offering in that time. Now, so those were the two basic ones. There is an additional service, though, that was done on high days. And that's called the... Do I know the name of it? Mashav, yeah. Which is... Yeah, Ma'arif means evening. The evening one that is now in the synagogues is actually one done in really what we would call the nighttime. And that's done at dark and on into you know, really dark time. It can be even up to midnight and still be legal and actual there. That really doesn't really tie into anything with temple. That was really an added thing later on there. It's called a mushav. Is that the right term? Musaf. Thank you. Musaf. Yeah. And he can probably do it for us there. So that's the Musaf is the official one, which is actually after the morning one, sometime around noon. So on special days, you have a prayer done in the morning, one done at noon, and one done in late afternoon. And those would be the three times a day that you'll see people like Daniel praying three times a day. And there's other examples of where the people are praying three times a day. I meant to say the third and the ninth hour, 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. being the hour of prayer. You'll find this in Acts chapter 10, when Cornelius was praying at the ninth hour, which is 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which it says the hour of prayer. And then you'll guess what? Then you'll find that Peter has gone up on the roof at the noon time, which would have been this time would be the additional time that he's praying when the angel appears to him. And then you can track through that Acts 10, the morning prayer and the evening prayer, how these guys, even this righteous Gentile Roman centurion, is actually praying at these times. Well, it's interesting that in the New Testament, you follow through that, you'll find Yeshua referring to, in the temple, he refers to the famous example is the publican who is standing and praying and saying, "Oh, I'm so righteous, and I give tithes to all, and I'm glad I'm not like this publican over there." But in the meantime, you have the publican standing away from him, who's also standing. It says standing afar off and beating on his breast and says, "Woe unto me, I'm a sinner." Which, by the way, you do, right, Jeremiah? You do that during... You do that during the Amidah and the forgiveness portion of the Amidah. You beat your breast there. Do you still do that, Jeremiah? Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, so that portion of the forgiveness, personal forgiveness, is still, it's still pounding on the breast. But Yom Kippur, even more so. I do it twice a day, because I think that those are the appointed seasons, and I think the other is good, but I think the scriptural example is the morning and the evening, except on the high days. Three times a day. It's been traditional since, yeah. Yeah, good Jew now prays three times a day, plus four times ownership.
Isn't that backwards? Shouldn't be evening and morning.
We're gonna save that topic for another feast.
Are the Amidah prayers the same every day of the week?
Anybody want to take a stab at that? Amidah is the same every day of the week? Aaron. Right, Aaron tells us that on the daily Amidah, you're having 18 or 19 portions, but on the Shabbat there is no petitioning, which is the middle 12 or 13, depending on you count 12 or 13 portions. So you have three portions of blessing God, one portion about the sanctity of the Sabbath, and the three portions about the thanksgiving to God. So that all turns out to be seven. The wonderful three, one, and three is seven. So seven on the Sabbath. And I get something out of that. I read a lot into that, because it's interesting that we pray for, if you go down those petitions, and I invite you, if you haven't done those, to dig out your Amidah and go through and look at those petitions. They're worthy things. They're praying for a prosperous year. They're praying for health. They're praying for healing for Israel. Praying for return, rebuilding of Jerusalem, return of Messiah. All wonderful things, but mostly about physical things there. But on the Sabbath, the point is, it's a time of rejoicing in the blessings that we have, and it's not the time to pray for health and healing and for prosperity and God give me a job, And So I think that's a really interesting point. I'm not saying it's a sin to do those things. I'm just saying that the rabbis at some point in the past, don't know when, established that rule, which I think is there's, you know, in spite of what we tend to be critical of rabbis, there is a lot of wisdom in their thoughts. Yes, Tom. Certainly okay. I would mention also in the Amidah, if you look through that, it is a rather rigid and structured thing, but it doesn't have to be so rigid. You can insert in there your own personal prayers. In fact, even in the rigid one, there are places when you're praying for the sick, it actually leaves a blank there to fill those in. And so one does not need to be tied or bound by this. It's a, in a sense, an outline and a structure that I think has some value.
I should say that in our synagogue that we go to once a month, it's a traditional synagogue, and at the end of the Torah service, I think it is, at some point anyway, there is prayer for healing for the sick, and there's actual, like, prayer requests, and during the prayers, it says, you know, bringing the Torah and healing to these certain people. Then it says, oh, the Shabbat forgives us from crying out.
Yeah. I don't want to make too much of that, because Yeshua showed that it was okay to heal on the Sabbath, you know. And so, don't make too much of that, but still there's a point that, you know, we should really be thinking about God's blessings and thankful for His, and using the Sabbath as kind of rejoicing rather than, you know, give me more. Yeah. Yes, Ellis? Oh, okay.
Interesting conceptually to not even ask God to do any work on the Sabbath. You know,
that's an interesting question.
We talked about the hour of prayer. What do the prayers have to do with sacrifices? I think that's the next.
So what do the prayers have to do with sacrifices? I think we've already shown that the time of this and the sacrifices are just not offered in just the isolated thing. The sacrifices were offered with prayer. And that goes way back to the very beginning of sacrifices. Prayers are always accompanying sacrifices. And so much so that as Isaiah says in Isaiah 51, my house shall be called a house of prayer. And because most of the people coming up were going watching for communal sacrifices, they weren't bringing the sacrifice. You didn't have to bring a sacrifice to enter into the temple. And because many of those were, you could, a personal thing, a trespass offering and so forth. You didn't have to, because they were things for the community. And so, but you still went up to there, and disciples continued to go up into the temple at the hour of prayer. And continued steadfastly, as it says in the New Testament, in deep prayer, which is meaning the Amidah. Now, did they do the Shema too? Well, probably, you know, but it, you know, because they're coupled together, and did they do many other prayers too? Probably, but it does specifically state they went up for the prayer or the Hatatofim. So sacrifices, were such. Now, when the sacrifices, ended at the destruction of the temple, the prayers then were considered by the Jewish community and by the rabbis to be a service of the heart. In other words, they couldn't go up and sacrifice in the temple. There was no temple, even though they wanted to continue to sacrifice, so the prayers continued to be a sacrifice to the Lord. And so it became known as a service of the heart, which is another topic somebody can pick up there. And to this day, if you go into the synagogue and you watch, it follows the temple rituals. Even in many of the scriptures that are read, particularly on holy days, describe the sacrifices that were going on, and in a way in which we can still provide that service, or the avodot, service of the heart.
I think the next question you covered, why are there only seven sections on the Sabbath? The next question, did the New Testament believers pray the Amidah? And if so, if you think they did, what is the evidence?
Okay, anyone want to? I think we've covered some of that already, haven't we? I can actually dig out the some of the references, but I'll save you that right now. We can talk about it. Tom.
If you were to introduce this to somebody trying to learn the Torah, and they were quick to say, but aren't these the repetitious prayers I talked about, how would you address that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What was his prohibition? Tom says, weren't these the repetitious prayers that Yeshua was talking about? And the answer is yes. But now your next question is, how would you reconcile that? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
It's a vain repetition.
Yeah.
These are pointed repetitions.
Yes, Simha says the qualifier is vain repetitions he was warning against. And these were appointed repetitions. Aaron.
Is it also African in this context that you have to create a repetition as the thing? So the idea wouldn't be famous.
You know, I don't know. Is that the way it's stated, you know, Olga? Oh, yeah.
Where the Catholicism prayer comes, what they do is these repetitions and stuff like that. Thinking about how the human brain works, you know, we tend to forget and go off in our own ways. I think Kevin wanted us, like, I put my son in a private school, which is a religious place. One of the teachers, every beginning of the class, everybody's standing, they're reciting Ten Commandments on our board. You know, we forget. We get tangled up into this and whatnot, and we forget. And by golly, when you keep, you know, jamming it in, at some point it's safe. Or it's keep it for at least a while. So I can't see where it would be vain repetition. As long as it's
with the meaning. Yeah. Olga says it's not vain repetition because we need that repetition to remind us as long as we have meaning into it. And I think that's probably a way of reconciling that is that these repetitions, are they vain? Well, they certainly could be. I mean, you'll see on the airplane occasionally or at an airport, you'll occasionally see some Orthodox Jews get off in the corner and they got their prayer book and, you know, they're watching that time, you know, but they got to get that in and boom, 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 and they put that thing so fast, is that like doing your rosary? Yeah, I can't judge them, you know, maybe they're thinking every word there. Jeremiah left, but Jeremiah really has a strong emotion about that coming from a rabbinical as a son of a rabbi, where things are whipped off really fast and the guys go out and continue sinning, is that he really has emphasis that you do these slow enough and you think about them. And in my own personal things, you know, I can't always get through 18, so I may just choose 3. You know, I'd rather do 3 slowly than 18 really fast. Real fast, you know. There is an official rabbinical blessed abbreviated form for emergencies. Yes. Aaron. Yeah, often by the river, and that's true. I mean, I see in my own synagogue, not pointing nobody's here, but it says one or two, that, you know, there are certain people who will, you know, during the praise and worship, they will go right up front, you know, and they'll take their hands and they'll wave back and forth just right up in front of everybody. And, you know, I'm judging them, huh? Yeah, who knows what's in the heart, but it's week after week after week, you know. And, you know, I'm wondering if they're wanting to be seen by God or being seen by people. I don't know. Not everyone does that, but it seems to be, you know, common in some people.
Some people,
oh, I'm not criticizing that. I'm waving their hands and, you know, they're really singing, but you need to go right up front, you know, in front of everybody else and doing the sentence. That may be the answer. Here I was judging those folks, and the answer was there's the back is packed out. Okay, next question.
And even the speed, I think, with daily repetition, I think sometimes speed is something that that you can still get meaning from even when doing it rapidly. Like for example, when you do dictations on your patients, you do this on a daily basis. How fast can you do the dictations and still understand and think through the process on those?
Well, actually, as you do it more, you can think faster.
You think faster in your recycling.
Practice does make perfect, huh?
Why pray morning and evening? Did we talk about that?
I understand.
How long did it take you to do this morning block?
I don't do it standing. I'll confess, I do it in my car on the way to work. So it's not really an Amidah, it's a Shimona Ezrei.
Now, which direction are you driving on the way to work?
Either way, I'm driving the opposite north.
Oh, yeah, on the way back. So the next question, maybe you touched on, why pray morning and evening? Do we think we talked about that?
Time's up, 4 minutes.
Okay, so how about
what's the question?
Why pray every morning and evening? How about what are the names of the morning and evening temple services? Did we talk about that?
Yeah, I think we just discussed those, the Shaharit and the Minha. And anybody wants these things written down and the references, I've got a whole list of really interesting any references. This book is great. One, How to Pray as a Jew. If you all have that, it's a popular old book, been around for, oh, I think 30 years or so, is a real good book. And it has a section on the Ma'amadot and the developing the Amidah in the beginning of that. Another book, Jewish Liturgy, A Comprehensive History by Ishmar Elogin. Oh, we didn't talk about the Genizar, that's right. Okay, scrolls. Okay. Anyway, this guy was actually the most prolific student, devoted his whole life to studying the Amidah and its history, from and other parts of literature, mainly on that, from the these old scrolls found in the Ezra synagogue. Which did you bring your kippah? Did you? This kippah we actually have from the Ezra Synagogue in Cairo that not Ellis, but one of his other brothers went with me there 25, 30 years ago, and you can still get into there. And it's within the Coptic community. The Coptics tend to protect it, and there's a few old, very poor Jews, you know, very, very poor Jews, and we bought a couple of kippahs from them, and you know, they had done stuff, and they were so thankful to get a little money. But anyway, it's a very, that's another story that we won't have time to tell you about. But
Jewish literature.
Yeah, send me an email, and I'll send you the whole bibliography about 8 or 10 references that I think you'll find interesting history. And you'll find some spiritual uplifting things in there, too.
Maybe,
okay.
Maybe
any more?
One more is who were the Anshei Ma'amad?
Yeah, we covered who the Anshei Ma'amad, or Anshei Ma'amadot, in plural, were the men of standing who went to the temple, watched the things, brought it back home, eventually established the prayers in the local Beit HaKnesset, or the synagogues, and that was the beginning of the synagogue prayer development. Anybody else have other questions? Other than the references? I will leave my cards out here. My wife is smart enough to make some cards here. And you can pick those up. It's got my email address on it. Just email me any questions or, you know, any thoughts you guys have. And for the references or any how to spell, whatever, you know. So make those available to you. Okay. Mm-hmm.